Welcome to the CFO Show. I'm your host, Melissa Howitson, CFO of Vena. As environmental concerns continue to shape global policies, CFOs must stay ahead of the curve by developing strategies that not only meet current requirements, but also anticipate future regulatory changes and shareholder expectations. This is the second installment in our two-part series on ESG and sustainability, following our initial focus on sustainability regulations. In this episode, we provide practical guidance for CFOs on navigating environmental regulations. Joining me for this discussion is Mark Lumsden Taylor. Mark is a partner and head of sustainability at MHA, the UK member firm Baker Tilly International, where he guides UK business leaders through the process of integrating environmental, social, and governance considerations into their operations. Let's jump back into our conversation with Mark. So you've clearly worked with lots of businesses, different sizes, and you hit the point in terms of companies always have decisions to make about where they're going to be investing their time and their money. What are some of the best practices that you've seen companies adopt that have helped them in terms of getting compliant when it comes to this reporting?
What gives me a really unique lens, which is something that I suppose I'm quite lucky. I trained in practice, so I dealt with oil and gas majors, financial services, you know, long before this stuff was a thing. You know, the stock exchange was still by, you know, the Bank of England, and we still had the telephone booths outside. I'm not that old, but this stuff was there. I then built an organization that was enshrined in the principles of doing good, societal impact, environmental impact, economic benefit to the region. And we created hundreds of millions of pounds worth of benefit. I then returned to practice. And because I had that experience being a CFO, running my own organization and knowing when we had, you know, when we had no money, what do you do? What is the impact on the supply chain? What does that impact if we don't pay those suppliers while we're their biggest customer? You get a different lens to when you talk about the legislation now, because I've sat in the CFO chair and I know what they should be doing. I also know what's bad and what you shouldn't do. And it gives MHA and us a kind of like a dynamic that says, well, actually, do it for the right reason, not for any old reason, and think beyond just ticking damn boxes for legislative purposes. And that's why I think our team here and the dynamics of the firm, because we've invested as much in what we do internally as we have externally. We're in the FT this week for that very reason on our approach, which was a really big deal for us. And that's what I think when we talk to businesses, they get and they trust us. So I just wanted to say that as well, because I'm a little bit different to the norm. I'm not your stereotypical auditor and accountant for a good reason.
Well, and it comes through. And when I think about it, at the end of the day, everyone wants to be doing meaningful work. Companies attract talent because of the type of work they're doing and what impact it's having in the world. And so there are so many benefits. It's good for our stakeholders, our employees, our customers, our supply chain, our investors ultimately. But that's the, you know, that's the lens we need to apply here. And but we have to make it practical as well. And so it's marrying all of that up and cost effective. Because at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. You know, that matters as well. So thank you so much.
Finish the deck, and at the end of the day, they'll say, how much? What am I getting for it? Because that's business and that's life. And what we say is how much, what are you getting for it? And the benefit from a sustainable economic and environmental perspective underpinned by societal licensing is what you get from MHA.
And that's the responsibility we have as business leaders to be able to synthesize it down that simply.
I'll start with kind of what we've seen integrated. And some of these examples are from large companies, but can be used on smaller and SME mid-cap as well, because the principles remain the same. First one is risk, right? Risk defines life. Whatever we're doing, there will be a fundamental risk attached to it. Those businesses that have integrated risk on sustainability into their registers and their processes and practices at a baseline level, not some overlay that the board sign off once a quarter, but have fundamentally questioned whether you're a manufacturer, making, I don't know, strawberry jam, food industry, so I'll give you a food example. What practices, and whether that's being made in the UK or out somewhere in Europe or I don't know, further afield, have you considered the environmental, social, and governmental impact of what you are doing? In other words, the machinery that's being used, the capture of data, the people that are doing those products, are making those products, their welfare, the way in which that business, so effluent will come out of a plant like that. What happens to that? Just go into a lagoon around the corner. Does that have a material impact? You know, and rather than just going, oh, yes, we've always done it, thinking about it from a different risk perspective, rather than going, oh, well, the risk is if we don't meet our quotas and orders on that particular jam line, then that's a risk. Yes and no. So considering all of those existing risks from an ESG, EESG, so environmental and environmental, social, governance, and economic. So we use two E's when we talk about this stuff. So doing that at a baseline across all of your risks is brilliant practice because it makes you think differently. What doesn't necessarily work is then just bolting on a separate environmental register. You will have additional environmental risks, but embed it within what you do already. Do you see my point? I've seen companies just knock up an environmental risk register, which you can do. But how does that then link to your other core risk register? Or are you just ticking boxes, guys?
And in doing that, what have been some of the biggest findings that, you know, the difference that's come to bear as people started linking that to the core risk register? What were the big aha moments in that?
I can say in two words, supply chain. Mm-hmm. Supply chain. The evaluation of how supply chain is managed, controlled, and reported, which has a direct impact on the day-to-day operations of business. And it could be services. So we're a service industry, right? MHA, Baker Tilly International. We have a supply chain. We use staff from all over the world. We have a supply chain of back office services. So for us, it's much more around societal. Environmental is less of a risk for us. But from a societal perspective, how are we procuring and managing that? What's our risk? What's our supply chain? What's our approach to welfare, well-being, and services and support? There's a whole pace around IT and all of that, of course, with societal licensing. You have to look at, it's not just about cybersecurity, but we hold data as a global firm for hundreds of thousands of people, of clients. What is the societal impact if there is ever a breach? God forbid. See my point? So it's thinking about risk differently. That then in turn, so that's why we call excellent practice, and that's where you start. That then leads to the whole approach around environmental social governance, number one. Number two, in terms of excellent practice at the other end of the spectrum, is governance. You will have no doubt been into businesses where this work has started. And where do you think it's ended up?
Going nowhere on a shelf.
Firstly. Secondly, we're not right sure. Give it to the finance director. They can sort it out. This isn't necessarily the case now so much, but nonetheless, you still do see elements of this. Oh, it's data, it's reporting, it's something to do with audit. Give it to the finance director. And the finance director thinks, well, how on earth am I going to cover that on top of everything else? I'll delegate to somebody in the finance office. And then it's built like that. And then you often see finance trying to pull reporting together and various sustainability and environmental and governance initiatives going around an organization. It's not joined up and coordinated because it's just been dropped. There needs to be a board strategic lead for sustainability and environmental social governance and everything else that is associated with that at a strategic lead level. And it can be the CFO, or it can be the products director, or the marketing director, or often, more often than not, there'll be a chief sustainability officer now in larger organizations, CSOs, new titles. When CMOs came out, chief marketing officers, you know, we've got CSOs. What do? Own it. And they have jurisdiction across all the other senior post holders to ensure that stuff gets done. Quite a lot of the time, it's the chief finance officer who will have a sustainability lead. If you don't have that, it's not a good place to be. Because I will guarantee, well, I know from fact, from experience, that when you try and you pull it in, it will end up with the FD because it's regulatory assurance ultimately, right? And they won't know what they're doing about it. It's because it hasn't been coordinated at the top. So the ownership at governance level makes the difference between a success and a fail. And a great example of this, I won't name the organization, obviously, is a business that is in transport logistics, have a fantastic approach to green transport, emissions, supply chain, finance knows nothing about it. And they're doing all the regulatory reporting. And nothing is joined up at all. And then we come along and go, where is it? So do you see my point? So the piece around risk and the piece around governance are the two fundamental things that will drive any organization to success. And I suppose the third thing, and I, of course, I'm going to say this, is you have a good independent objective advisor, or we often call, what I call them is the critical third eye. And by that, I mean, they're not your auditors, not your accountants, but what they are the people that come in and they either build it for you or they review it. So we part of the stuff that we do is an internal audit function where we come in. We might have built it a year ago. That's fine. They've gone on with it. We come in with a fresh third eye and go, here's what's right. Here's what's wrong against regulations and what's coming down the track. And that's probably linked to this third point. So you might be here at the minute. Regulation is here. But where do you think regulation's going? It's coming down. And even if you're still here, it's going to come down and down and down and down. And whether you like it or not, you're going to drop into scope. So to quote an organization I spoke to yesterday, what is the minimum I need to do to ensure that I am not going to get caught out in a year's time? We said, okay, well, you're going to be around the 2 mark, aren't you? Full compliance. So we'll prepare something on that basis. And businesses need to be thinking like that. Just because you're not in scope now doesn't mean that you're not going to be. And that's where your critical third eye comes into play. You do those three things and I can't guarantee anything because as auditors, we have to provide an opinion like lawyers. But I will say you will position yourself to meet what's coming ahead if you do that. If you ignore it and just wait for the auditor to say you're not compliant, like I have dealt with some organizations, whilst that is a road you go, fine, you will miss opportunities. You will underestimate the level of regulation and force coming. And the third thing that actually is the thing that wakes up most directors and businesses is, well, you don't do any of that, but your customers are. And let's say they're listed on, I don't know, the New York Stock Exchange, and they've got a supply chain in Europe, and the SEC expect those New York Stock Exchange businesses to report their Scope 3 emissions in 2027. And you're not doing any of that because you can't be bothered and you do the bare minimum. What do you think that's going to do to your customer supply relationship? Do you think they're going to be really happy with that? I don't think they probably will, because if they don't report correctly and their reporting is weak, and let's say it's so under Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, you have to be assured independently under this standard called the International Standard on Assurance Engagement 3000, moving to standard on 5000 next year. You have limited assurance, moving to reasonable assurance. But if it's not satisfactory, you'll get a limitation in scope, or worse still, qualified. If you're limited, if you get a limitation in scope by, let's say, BTI or MHA BTI, that goes over to the auditors in the US, and they would say they're, I don't know, PwC. PwC will have an issue with that because it's limitation in scope, which means they're limited in scope, which means their opinion might be limited in scope if it's material. What do you think that's going to do to the market listing of that particular business when they publish their report and accounts? Well, the market may just go and go, oh, it doesn't matter. It's unlikely, isn't it? They'll probably still have a bit of a problem with that. So you think about the chain, but that's what I'm trying to get businesses to listen to now. We're not we're not trying to frighten business, but we're trying to say is just look at what's on the walls, guys.
The CFO Show is brought to you by Vena, the only complete planning platform natively integrated with Microsoft 365. With Vena, your finance and operations team can maximize your productivity and efficiency to deliver data and insights to your whole business faster. Vena lets your team use the Microsoft apps they already know and love, like Excel and PowerPoint, while giving your business the power of scale through a robust centralized database and AI capabilities. Learn more at venasolutions.com.
But what we're trying to say is just look at what's on the walls, guys.
And so, you know, it becomes clear for companies that this is something that companies are going to have to do. Like you said, we're all part of a larger supply chain selling to other companies that may be in or out of scope here. And so for CFOs who are just starting to think about their climate-related disclosures and where to go, how should they go about that? Where do you typically see the responsibilities start? Because they won't start with having it, you know, a C-level person who's owning it. And at what point do they even think about bringing in that first hire to actually own it what has that journey looked like for companies?
If it's a commitment you want to make, it has to start at the top of the organization. And let's say, for argument's sake, because it's data and reporting, most people, when they talk about this stuff, talk about emissions, don't they? Whilst it might not be the only thing, it is the first thing that people talk about. So that invariably will mean the finance director or the person that is responsible for a form of reporting, whatever size of the business, right, will have to take responsibility for it. So the first thing that they should do is assess exactly what they want to do and what they should do. So from a legal perspective, what they have to do. And remember, what we haven't touched on actually is, so we've talked about all the financial regulations, and it'll be the same in the US, although I'm not as knowledgeable in this sort of side. In Europe, we have this project called Fit for 55. You may have heard of it. And what that means is a 55% reduction in overall emissions by 2030. And what that does is a whole series of regulations ranging from the Renewable Aviation Fuel Directive through to the Carbon Border Adjustment Mechanism Directive about if you can generate the product more carbon friendly in Europe versus importing it, you should be doing it in Europe. And if you're not doing it in Europe, then there's a tax on that import. Basically, it's an additional tax. So it's called CBAMS mechanism and other matters as well. So businesses will be in various compliance for those things as well. So forget the regulation, the big ones. They'll be doing things. And there'll be stuff around workforce and labor. I don't think there's so much in the US, but there will be aspects of that. And there's some more stuff in Canada. So you assess that. And the finance director says, okay, this is what we know we're legally responsible for. There might be something about effluent or around environmental treatment. All of that is part of sustainability. Treatment of discharge into the water table or the land tables, right? Once that's been decided, depending on the whole nature and scope of the business, the decision has to be taken as well. How far further do we decide to do that? And within that, you'll no doubt, and I think you're finding this more and more and more, customers will be asking them, well, we need to report on our emissions, scope one, scope two, sometimes scope three. We need to know what your emissions are because we have to report them. Therefore, you have to have some form of reporting or analysis of what your contribution is, because otherwise businesses won't buy from you. And even if you just stop at that point, at least you have some form of protection and structure in place. For some businesses, that's enough. So take world that I work in, farmers and growers, right? They often supply multinational companies, big ones. They have now been told to collate their emissions and collate what they are doing around treatment of labor, treatment of workforce, minimum wage, minimum salary. That will all come through 9 times out of 10, the owner manager with their finance manager, and they'll pull that together. And then the supermarkets will take that information and use that as part of their reporting. And for a lot of those businesses, that's as far as they will go. Now that's, in my world, that's not satisfactory. They need to go further, but from a resource perspective, at least they've started it. So as a bare minimum, you need to have those processes in place. And there are digital tools out there that accountants firms like ours and others can provide. Even your auditors may be able to do that with accountants. And you start with that. But I emphasize what I said earlier is you need to get a third-party opinion, because your business might be required to do that by your customer and you have nothing else to do. But legislation is coming down the track. And 2026, 2027, we'll see the adoption of more legislation. So your data and numbers for the year after next, or actually even next year perhaps, will be your baseline for what you'll be expected to report the following year. So companies will need to understand and have that data ready now. Because remember, whenever you do a set of accounts, what do you do? Current year numbers and last year's numbers. So even if you don't have to report until 2026, you'll be expected to have the prior year data. So don't just think, oh, I can wait for a year. Start to plan and prepare. European legislation applies to smaller companies in 2027, but they're using 2026 data. So if I was that sort of company, I'd be thinking, right, I need to have 2025 as well, because I'm not going to look where I need to be if I can't see some sort of trend analysis. Mm-hmm. So that's what the smart money's doing, because it's here.
And so when you look at what's coming in the future, which is not so distant even, what are some of those key upcoming trends that companies should be aware of and thinking about now?
So just to give you a bit of perspective, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive was enacted and approved by the European Commission, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It then has to get adopted in all the member states into their laws for application. And those member states can apply it in the way that they want. So they can apply exemptions. They can add additional thresholds. They can add additional disclosures if they choose. So in Europe, the Republic of Ireland has taken it to the nth level. So no one can actually even provide assurance unless they do a minimum, I think, of 50 hours direct reported and regulated CPD, so continued professional development. I've just gone through it. Even though I know it, I've had to do it again because that's their rules. They're very forensic. Equally though, other jurisdictions, Norway, there's a lot of exemptions applied there to support companies on that journey. So I would say this Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, and whichever country you are in, some countries have adopted it, some are in the process of adopting it. So Austria have yet to adopt. They've just gone through some quite tough elections, but the legislation is there for companies that they have to adhere to. They just haven't enshrined it in law yet. So my best advice for now is look at where you sit in that rollout, because that rollout's agreed now, so it's happening. That's for Europe. And also, you could have subs in Europe that mean you have to report your group reporting in the US, for example, with the European legislation, and look at which element is related. We look at which way you need to report, whether it's global reporting, entity level reporting, exemption reporting, artificial reporting. There is a whole different range of things you need to do. The other thing that's going to catch people out as well, so that's CSRD, is EU taxonomy, which is also relevant to companies for 25 and 26 reports, 26 reporting based on 25 data. And that is where you only report if you satisfy all the standards within EU taxonomy and do no material harm. That's the test. And basically, it's the highest possible level of sustainability action that a company takes. So I only report on the excellent work if you satisfy EU taxonomy. It's not the other way around. So if nobody's reporting on it, you know they're not excellent. It's clever to reverse. So that's something that's now... that legislation is waking up companies to go, oh my goodness, it needs to be properly assessed, and auditors are expected to do that as well. So that's kind of the European standards. UK is as is at the minute. We've just had a change in government. I expect them to adopt a form of S1 and S2, which is the International Sustainability Standards Board, which is kind of more of what we're doing at the minute. I really, really, really hope, and we're certainly guiding companies to think more about double materiality in corporate sustainability reporting, because that's where it's going to go. In the United States, you've got that cascade. And again, this is the whole trading relationship as well. If a global organization in the United States, and it's listed or it's large, it's got loads of trading relationships in Europe, and they're not doing anything other than the bare minimum, what's that going to do to the trading relationship on the basis of what Europe is expecting? And my view is, the US should certainly be thinking about what the European drive means to those corporates. And we deal with a lot of corporates that sit in both. And we say, yes, there's a cost involved. But well, let's look at what the medium and long-term benefits will be by you doing it now.
Mark, thank you so much. I found this conversation so helpful in terms of demystifying this area of sustainability and ESG. I only wish you were a little more passionate about this topic because that didn't come through. In terms of...
I thought you were serious. I was thinking, are you kidding me? Honestly.
Absolutely not.
Honestly, if this doesn't work out, you should do like deadpan comedy or something. You actually not many people have me, and you had me there. I'm thinking, are you for real?
It's so clear that this is an area that you know inside out. And I love your passion helps to bring, you know, make it real. Why does it matter? Practically speaking, how should companies be going about it? So appreciate that so much. Now, whenever we do have a guest on, we do have two rapid fire questions we like to ask. So are you ready for those?
Yeah, sure.
I'm going to give you my first question. First one is, What is your go-to strategy to stay productive during the day?
I have a philosophy, and it's really simple. It's only impossible until it is not. So I have a mindset that it doesn't matter what I'm about to go into, which is usually my day that's planned, changes rapidly from about 7 a.m. I work on the basis that I will still absolutely deliver everything I tend to plan that day. But I go in with a mindset of, we'll deal with it. Whatever comes up, we will deal with it. So that's my philosophy at the start of the day. And I've used that, goodness me, I've used that for a very, very, very long time. People call it an MLT centricity. They do.
And the other one is, what helps you to turn a bad day around?
There are those that make it happen. There are those that watch it happen. There are those that never knew it happened in the first place. And you have to tick which box you are in. And when it's going wrong, I bring around me the people that I know will make it happen. And we collectively then get it done. I'm very fortunate that I have an incredibly loyal and supportive team. And I think I've always engendered loyalty. So when I built my organization back in the mid-2000s, we started with a very tight team. And it didn't matter how bad the day got, we'd fix it. And if we had to work 24 hours, then that's what we did. And now the philosophy is, well, it's going wrong. Let's get the team around me that's going to help and let's fix it. And that whole philosophy of it's only possible till it's not, but underpinned by pushing ourselves even harder. We don't fail. And like a well-known pizza company, we always deliver.
Such great advice. Thank you so much. It's clear, you know, the work that Baker Tilly and yourself is doing is having a broad, broad impact. So thanks for sharing your insights with our audience today.
You're very welcome indeed. And I hope it has helped the listeners and the watchers and the people that are on this journey. It's an important journey, and it's one that I think people need to really think about long and hard and go back to first principles.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more, sign up for our free newsletter, where each week you'll get a roundup of exclusive resources designed to help you grow your leadership skills and drive strategic transformation across your business. Visit thecfoshowpodcast.com to sign up now. For The CFO Show, I'm Melissa Howitson. Until next time.